When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. We're in the presence of rock royalty today with a musician, performer, and author who in recent years has also become a distinct voice reflecting on how we deal with the process of grief, Nick Cave. As leader of the Bad Seeds, Cave is well known for his dark take on the songwriting craft, which can range from the beauty of lovelorn ballads such as Into My Arms to the wild screeching excesses of his early band in the 1980s, The Birthday Party. He's forged a path in the decades since that pairs writerly world weariness with a gothic-tinged gallows humour. And in between, he's branched out into soundtracks for film, collaborated with artists such as Kylie Minogue, PJ Harvey, and also the late Shane McGowan. The Pogues frontman sadly passed away on the day of this recording. Nick Cave's most recent book is Faith, Hope and Carnage. It's a collection of writing formed from conversations between Cave and the Irish journalist and critic Sean O'Hagan. The book touches on the musician's evolution as an artist and also some of the tragic events that have informed his recent work. Cave's son Arthur died in 2015. This recording took place at St. Martin in the Fields Church in London in late November. It's a great discussion, and did you know, if you're an Intelligence Squared member, you can get the full special extended version. Head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, and you'll get not only the extended edit, but also all of our premium podcast episodes, ad-free listening, and updates on our live events too. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now let's join Sean O'Hagan talking Faith, Hope and Carnage with Nick Cave.
Thank you. Hello.
Some familiar faces in the front row. Follow us around everywhere. Thank you all for coming. Before we start, we just agreed we should... The event is somewhat shaded by sadness tonight because of the news of the death of Shane McGowan, who is a close friend to both of us, and very upsetting news. In fact, the first time that you met Shane was when I brought him to that infamous interview in 1989 for the NME, and they've had a very, very strong friendship and relationship ever since.
Yeah.
So. It's a great genius, as we all know. I mean, you can talk about his songwriting better than I can. But a sad day.
Yeah, it's a very sad day today. We knew he was ill for a long time, but and you prepare for these sorts of things, but it was a shock.
Yeah.
It's a shock. And, you know, the world's lost a great artist, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a great human being in some ways.
Sorry,
and a great human
very
being.
Very echoey here.
It's incredibly echoey.
Yeah. Say that again.
And a great human being.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was something, I don't know if people know, you know, his reputation precedes him in a way, but Shane was an incredibly kind, sort of generous, pure spirit. And just an extraordinary person, an extremely funny guy, and just, in my view at least, the songwriter of his generation. I don't know too much about Irish music, you probably know a lot more about it than I do, but I would say he's, you know, sitting up there.
Oh, for sure.
You know, within the whole historical context as one of the great songwriters,
yeah,
Irish songwriters, and greatest
great songwriters in, per se, I think, yeah, general. There's a sort of raw honesty to his work that I've never found anywhere else, really.
Yeah. He always had something that I didn't quite understand back then, when I first met him, was a genuine compassion towards people. You know, he was just kind to people, even though he was caustic and sort of had this rough edge to him. He was enormously generous and kind to ordinary people.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
You know, and just an extraordinary guy. I'm just, it's just very sad today.
Yeah, yeah. I have one story. You've reminded me of a story when I got a call from him once, and the Pogues were, I think, number two in the charts with Fairy Tale. And he said, oh, come and meet me in King's Cross before it was gentrified. Come and meet me in the Wimpy Bar in King's Cross. We were living the dream in those days. And I remember I turned up, and he was always an hour late, but I suddenly noticed this commotion, and there was two guys who I thought were homeless scrabbling about on the side of the road. And one of them was Shane. And he'd basically given money to a homeless person, and the notes had blown away. And the both of them were running around trying to. And I remember thinking, like, I can't imagine a pet shop boy scrabbling around in the gutter on King's Cross. But yeah, it said something about his sort of authenticity.
I saw that a lot with him.
Yeah.
He would carry around a big roll of cash to give to people, essentially.
Yeah. Anyway.
A beautiful person, and he'll be greatly missed, I think.
Yeah. We should go in. We're here ostensibly still.
We're still
on.
Plugging this.
Year on. There's life
so
in the
good.
Old dog yet. To talk about all the sort of themes that come up in the book. But we're also going to talk about music, which Nick is often reluctant to do, because I think you finished mixing an album, a Bad Seeds album, yesterday.
It came back mastered today. So that means, I don't know if you know what that means, but... You mix the record, you make the record, no, you write the record.
Yeah.
No, you get asked by your manager to make a record, so you write the record, and then you take it into the studio and record the record, and then you take it to someone and mix the record, and then you send it off, and someone masters the record, and that means it's ready to be released into the world, and it sounds fucking awesome. I mean, I'm just saying. It's been an extraordinarily difficult record to make for some reason. I remember Lou Reed saying something about, after a while, you understand that the next record will come and things just get easier. I've not found that to be the case.
No.
At all. And each record just becomes more difficult to arrive at that place, and this record was extremely difficult, but it's you know, it's really good.
That's not the feeling I got from you over the last few months. It felt very positive, and maybe you were on the last.
Well, I'd finished writing it. Finished. It's the lyric writing that's extremely difficult for me. You know, because I'm trying to say something with my lyrics. I'm not just trying to collect a bunch of songs together. I'm trying to sort of find the thing that I want to say. And that's quite difficult, record after record.
Can you talk about the thing you want to say on this record?
No.
No. Can you talk about the title of the record?
No.
Okay.
It's a great title, though. Fuck.
It is the best title yet. But it is a Bad Seeds record, as opposed to...
Yeah, it's got all the Bad Seeds on it.
Yeah, and you've just got back from Buffalo, upstate New York, with David
Friedman.
That's
right. The way it's tended to be over the last few records is that me and Warren tend to mix the records. But this is a very complex record, and we sort of finally come to a sort of latter-day realization that we don't know what we're doing in the studio and that we need somebody else to do it. So we took it to Dave Fridman, who used to be in Mercury Rev, and he did all the Flaming Lips records, and which are really beautifully put together, those records. And he mixed it and did an amazing job. So,
while you hung out.
He had this weird way, which was extraordinary for me and Warren, who are so a couple of complete control freaks about everything. He would say in the morning, you mix it in like a shack in the woods, and in his studio in Buffalo. He said, "Well, what do you want this song? I'm going to mix this song today. What do you want it to sound like?" And you're like, it's, you don't play the song. You just sort of describe it to him like that. And he goes, "Okay, thank you." And he goes into the studio and he locks the door and doesn't allow us near the record. And then at 3 o'clock, he comes out and says, "I have something to show to you. Would you care to comment?" And we go in and listen to it. It was just like, fucking hell, this is amazing. So we were really suspicious about this process to begin with, because we didn't really know what this guy could do, but he was amazing. And he turned songs that were difficult, sort of balancing acts into things that were really beautiful. So he's done an amazing job.
Meanwhile, you and Warren were hanging out in the Great
Western. Yeah, we just sit in the kitchen, kind of
in the Great Western in Buffalo, the Great Western Hotel in Buffalo.
Yeah, stayed in the Best Western.
Best Western.
Yeah.
Living the dream, man.
Yeah, 2 stars. in fact, there was I got quite friendly with one of the cleaners there, and she said,
"She's on the next record."
Huh?
She's on the next record.
Well, she might be, but she was this. Wonderful woman, and the people in the Best Western were quite interesting. And she said, "So you're in a band? I hear you're called the Bad Seeds, and why are you called the Bad Seeds?" And I said, "Well, because we're evil." And she goes, "You're not evil. I work at the Best Western. I've seen evil."
Brilliant.
I'm like, "Oh, okay." "I have a nice night."
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we stayed there, and it was just an amazing experience. So.
And you recently finished, I was going to say a solo tour, but it was you and Colin from Radiohead. And I must say, I saw it in New York, and it was quite extraordinary, the difference between a solo piano concert by you and this guy playing quite minimal bass, but it was such an extraordinary difference he made to the songs.
Yeah, you said something like that kind of kept going through my mind as I did future concerts. It was so lovely to hear him play, or you could really hear him when you could really hear it when he wasn't playing, or something like that, which wasn't entirely encouraging, but but it was an incredible experience too. I've just got sort of triumph exhaustion or something at the moment. Everything's been so good. This tour has just really reacquainted me with my songs. There's something about singing songs with a band, singing songs with the Bad Seeds. There's so much that's going on stage that you have to kind of remember and consider and deal with, and the relationship with the audience and what all the different people in the band are doing, and the kind of the intensity and the volume of everything, that the song itself, or the sort of essence of the song, gets kind of lost in the maelstrom of it all. And it was something else to just sort of sit there just with the words and sing them and kind of remember what the songs were actually about. A lot of the songs were played in the way that I would kind of present them to the to the band, you know, I'd come along and I'd have a song and I'd play it on the piano, and they would, the Bad Seeds would then go ahead and do something with it. But so it was really quite, it really made me understand what the project that I've been involved in the last 45 years or however long it is, it's not what I thought it was, which was a kind of forward-moving thing that keeps shedding its skin and moving on and shedding its skin. And it's actually a kind of, it's just this collection of songs that are all in dialogue with each other over the years. And the whole thing is a sort of broad church that is a thing unto itself. I always sort of saw the creative process as a kind of deliberate sort of murdering of what I've done before to create something new. But playing these songs at these concerts, I realized that actually these songs are the same, and they've been on about the same things from the beginning, and the preoccupations are essentially the same. And it became, I learned a lot from doing it. And Colin Greenwood was such a beautiful person to work with, because he followed me rather than sort of, I followed the band, he followed me. So I was able to sort of go wherever I wanted with the songs, and he just had this uncanny ability to land the notes at the right place and stuff like that. So it's a great pleasure.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So when you, just to go back to what you said, when you had this realization, what do you now think those preoccupations are?
Well, I mean, maybe this is clear to everybody, but it just wasn't clear to me as such, but the religious nature of the songs was just, it's funny because this priest or vicar came along to one of the shows that I'd met in London, and he'd never heard the band before, but he wanted to come along and in Minneapolis. And I kept singing the songs, and just about every second song had Jesus in it. And I kept thinking, fuck, this guy must think I'm sort of some religious nut. You know, that they were from the beginning, in a way, religious songs. There was that. And the idea of loss has always been there. So there was just a lot of things, that themes that I feel that I've freshly engaged in, that I've actually been involved in from the start, you know.
It's hard for me to go back and look at some of the early songs as having those preoccupations. They seem much wilder and less.
Yeah, they are
a bit more profound.
They're wilder, but so the intent is similar. The sort of idea of transcendence and the attempt of bringing the audience together in some way, whether it was in love or sort of contempt or whatever, it was the same idea in some kind of way. Some sort of attempt to sort of shed the present day preoccupations and move to something, to step into something else. And we did that in different sorts of ways. But
is it ever difficult for you when you sit at the piano that you're not engaging, you're not out on the lip of the stage, you're not doing that?
Yeah, it's a little disconcerting because I sort of feed off the audience and feed off the expressions on people's faces and the communal nature of the thing. It feels like a sort of circular thing, and I'm not really watching the audience as I'm playing, so it's different.
And I know this record, it's obviously a Bad Seeds record as opposed to a Nick Cave, or indeed a Nick Cave Warren Ellis record. Does it conform in any way to the things that you talked about in here, like the improvisatory nature of music?
Yeah.
That's still at the core of what you do.
Yeah, it is, but I don't want to go into too much about what the record's like, but it's just insanely good.
Okay, the hint is taken. So in terms of the book, I can't even remember how, it's over a year since it was published.
It's becoming a little obscene now that we're still talking about it.
And it's about 2 or 3 years since we did it.
Yeah.
So that's quite a lot of time. Have you ever read it?
The book?
I actually haven't read it since it came out. I dipped into it, but I sort of go...
Well, you mean read it from beginning to end?
Yeah, sit there and pour and make notes. I don't know. No, I don't feel the urge to dip into it very much. Sad to say. What about you?
No.
Good. Do you listen to your own records?
No.
No. How do you
accept the last one because it's so good?
How do you feel? Has your feelings towards it changed?
I do open it up sometimes and have a look, and I'm surprised by it, and I like it. I think it stands up. I'm interested to see what I was thinking about back then has now changed to some degree, or things move on, or. But the thing I love about the book, and I'll be eternally grateful to you for, is engaging me in a conversation that allowed me to sort of consolidate all the sort of random thoughts that were just floating around in my head about all manner of things in conversation. And I'd just never really done that before. You know, we sat down and had a conversation about things that I'd never talked about, essentially. I mean, I'd written things in the Red Hand files and stuff, but never really had any pushback or anyone pushing the thoughts on. And I love that about the book, that it starts in one place and ends somewhere else. Much more interesting, much more deeper, much more meaningful through the process of conversation. I've said this before, but the thing about this book for me is that it is a testament to the value of the necessary value of conversation.
And why do you think that, I kind of know the answer to this, but why do you think that is so important right now?
Because, I mean, you know, this has changed a little bit, I think, from when we were talking about that in the book, but I feel that certainly at the time of talking about that, I thought that the idea of conversation was being looked at with suspicion, that that the idea of an open conversation was starting to be looked at as something that was a kind of dangerous thing to do. And I just felt very strongly that that wasn't the case, and that we need more speech rather than less speech. And I was very concerned with that at the time. I'm not so sure I'm so concerned with that now. I think things are changing and people are kind of, growing a little tired of that. But the internet's flooded with podcasts, with people having, you know, open, good faith conversations and so forth. So I think that the tide has turned in that respect. But I think when we were writing it, there was still that feeling of you needed to be careful about what you talked about. And
You have, in the Red Hand Files, in the book, and in a lot of these conversations, become, I mean, I hope I'm not presuming too much here, but you've become more adept at speaking and articulating your loss, your personal loss with Arthur, and even with Jethro later, though he wasn't sort of, that happened after the book. Has that happened through the actual doing of it, through the fact that you were given a sort of format or a forum to clarify your thoughts?
Yeah, I just found, it's a funny thing to write about loss. It's, even though you're being open, it's also a kind of obscuring mechanism to the way that you actually feel. If you can sort of write about it and talk about it and articulate it, it keeps the actual feelings weirdly at bay, I noticed. And that there's deep sort of chasms of grief that talking doesn't really help. And so on some level, to keep talking is just to hold the feelings and this new world at bay in some way. I don't really know what I mean by that, except that sometimes it's not the talking that is the thing that eventually leads you out of the darkness. It's the humanness of people and small acts of kindness and practical matters. And, you know, I mean, I don't really, maybe this is not the right, Victoria rang me today, Shane's wife, I could recognize that situation she's in, of thousands of people coming around and everyone making demands on her because people are so upset. And it really ultimately is the small, silent acts of kindness that you barely see happen that are the things that draw you out of yourself. You know, I'm talking about someone making you a cup of tea, mm-hmm. And all the language that I've grown quite good at talking about is a thing for another time. It's a thing for something where you've gotten beyond, where you can reflect. The way I talk about it is sort of reflection, I think. You pushed me in the book to talk about what actually happened, and you wanted me to talk about what happened on the day that Arthur died. Well, you were concerned that I was talking forever from the other side of the chasm, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was suddenly, shockingly difficult. And I realized that I'd never actually, for all the language, I'd actually never really talked about those things. So,
do you regret that?
No, I don't regret it, but...
difficult stuff.
Yeah, it was something to hear Victoria today. It really brought it. You know, it was.
Yeah, take you back there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you hear about these things and they hit you, but they don't hit you. And talking to Victoria, it really hit me that Shana died, because he was sort of reflected by through her feelings, you know.
Yeah. And loss is kind of embedded in this book, the idea of it. And recently you did a quite amazing podcast with a woman whose name now escapes me, Krista Tippett.
Yeah.
And you said there that you felt now that loss was, you can put this better than me, but it was the defining condition of our lives. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's personally how I see the way we are as human beings. I don't think the condition of life is greed or
power.
Or power, yeah, or tyranny or these sorts of things. I don't think that's what, or oppression. I don't think these are the things that define what we are as human beings. I sort of reject those notions. And I think that there is a commonness about us all that is to do with loss. And I think that's born into us. It's our condition of life, that we're bright things born into loss. And I don't mean that in a depressing way. I mean loss very much, not just in historical loss or our collective loss as a society or our ultimate personal loss and the loss of the people around us. I don't mean that in a depressing way. I think that's understanding about things is what gives our life substance and meaning. It's that fundamental understanding that we die. I don't agree with the concept of the denial of death. It's an acceptance, I think, of death, that we have a fundamental understanding of that, whether we can talk about it or not. It's there in our blood and bones, and these things that we do, art or religion or these sorts of things, are a kind of celebration. They're not a denial, but rather a celebration of the meaning of what it is to live in such a precarious situation.
Yeah, and I take it you don't. I think you've said this before, but you don't feel that the idea of closure or even acceptance is really applies as we understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I think as Krista Tippett.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm having a.
You're like me. Too old. Trying to remember names.
I objected to the word closure, and I think she made a comment that word had long been sort of debunked as this idea of closure is ridiculous.
Is it not what people crave for, though?
Well, I don't want closure. I don't even look for acceptance. You know, I just think it's a living part of what I am. These losses and all the losses are a living part of the fabric of what I am. It's not something that I can, have closure with and put over there and then continue my life as it was. It's not as it was, nor should it be. You know.
Could you have gotten through this or dealt with it had you not had the religious aspect of your life, the deep religious dynamic that you have?
I get quite nervous when you say deep religious.
Well, it's certainly deep.
Because it is deep and it's religious, but it doesn't mean what that feels like it means.
Okay.
And that's a sort of a certainty about these matters. I know a lot of deeply religious people, and they're fundamentally different. They seem fundamentally different than I am in regard to religion. I feel very conflicted in regard to religion, but I do feel that I move or inch towards some kind of spiritual truth. I'm not there yet, but it feels fundamental to the way I am and the journey that I'm on. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's not without its deep skepticism and doubt and, you know.
I thought that
and I mean, and this is something is often misunderstood too. I find out how I misunderstood through the Red Hand Files, because people send in questions and they say, well, you know, now that you're a Christian or something like that, or even worse, now that you're a Tory, I keep getting. And I'm like, what the fuck? Where did that come from?
So you got that one from me?
I mean, I guess these things must, I don't go on social media, but these ideas must be coming from social media because they're so stupid.
Well, you did say, I think probably jokingly, that, you know, to be a conservative was the thing.
Well, I used the word conservative some time ago to talk about a kind of a way of approaching the world, and that was immediately seen as being a Tory, and that didn't even occur to me, or so I object to that, and I just want to set the record straight. I'm UKIP.
Oh God.
Oh, he's UKIP. He's UKIP.
Yeah, I was just seeing as an opening.
No, I'm not.
Well, that's a relief.
No, but I mean, I don't know where we are in the conversation now, but
you're not a conservative and you're not a Christian.
Well, the word conservative for me has something to do. We have to sort of look at it in a different way. And I was trying to describe what I felt the conservative temperament might be. And to me, it has something to do with the soul. I know in your mind you couldn't imagine such a thing, but it has something to do with a depth of understanding about our society and a kind of stewardship over the traditions of our society in some kind of way, and that they have some intrinsic value. That's all. That they're not set in stone. But they are worth protecting and expanding. So because the conservative temperament has something to do with a kind of melancholy, soulful feeling towards the world, or a fundamental understanding of loss, in that the things that we lose, it's very easy to lose things. and very hard to get them back. And so that's what I was really talking about in regard to a conservative nature, the fundamental desire to conserve in some way the collected wisdom of the world. And, you know, I don't think that makes me a Tory.
No.
So anyway, I don't know why we're talking about that, but we were talking about...
No, I find it interesting that you talk about... Well, let's move on to God and Christianity. You talk about the traditionalism of Christianity. You practice, you go to church.
Yeah.
But if someone calls you a Christian, you immediately recoil in horror.
Well, that's because I recoil with horror when someone says they're a Christian. You know, someone comes up to me and goes, "Hey, I'm a Christian." I go, you know, it worries me. I react. The skeptic in me is the sort of my default setting, and it always has been. And I have part of my interest in church and interest in the sort of mystical nature of these sorts of things is that journey taken away from that skeptical person, that, you know, that default setting that I have of suspicion and skepticism about these sorts of things. Because I feel that when I do move away, when I shed that skepticism, something happens to me that is really is a transcendent thing. It happens, and for me personally, I find that in a church. I get that in a church. I get that within a Christian ceremony, for example, because I always have, as a child, really responded weirdly to the story of Christ. I'm not quite sure why, and it's that narrative story that exists within the Christian religion that sort of draws me to it in the way that I'm not drawn to other religions. I'm not really drawn to the abstract nature of God, let's say. I feel uncomfortable to sit. It needs that human element, and I think that that's what that interests me about the Christian story.
It's essentially a human story, I guess.
Yeah, it's a human story that I relate to very strongly, and different parts of that story through different periods of my life.
I've always felt, looking at it slightly detached, having had a religious upbringing. It's hard to go back into that, but in a detached way, I always think of faith as essentially private.
Yes.
But you say it's a communal thing that you like.
Well, it is a communal thing to be part of a church service, obviously. And there's great benefits in that, and I think people get a lot out of that. But I'm much the same as you. It's a private matter for me as well.
And the deepening of the faith I talked to...
I mean, what I've noticed happening, we can get off this subject soon.
Yeah.
But what I have noticed happening is there is a movement towards Christianity that disturbs me, which is a politically motivated movement towards Christianity that I've noticed amongst people that feel like it's. They can use Christianity as some sort of firewall or bulwark against the current cultural moment or other fundamentalist religions or whatever. And I see Christianity being used in that way. And that's not my interest in Christianity. My interest in Christianity is, as you say, entirely personal and emotional. It's an emotional thing.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing in the book. Well, you talk about the prescience of songs and that they can almost foretell certain things before they happen. And I just listened to you. It seems like that preoccupation you've always had with God and the songs and all, kind of on a bigger level foretold where you were going, foretold your journey.
Say that again.
The notion that a single song, for instance, can be present.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
That can be applied to the whole, the realization you had recently with Colin that...
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. I mean, that's quite right. I mean, it was doing that. You know, it's playing very old songs and they felt very new to me. They felt like they were addressing exactly the things that were sort of preoccupying me. It was quite a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It's a very beautiful show to perform, you know.
And your work rate seems quite, I mean, it's always been prodigious, but has it accelerated as you've got older?
It
appears that way to me, but maybe it was always thus.
My plan is to sort of strip it back or strip it down, because there's all these extracurricular things that are going on, but the thing is, the more well-known you get, the more interesting the things that come in are, you know, like the people want you to do or collaborate with or get involved with, you know. So it's hard to...
Is it hard to balance that reflective life you talk about?
Well, exactly. This is the problem with touring. It's very hard to have your life is eternally interrupted by your creativity, actually. Certainly touring. I find I'm always having to sort of go back to the place I was at before I went on tour. Going on tour is a sort of spiritual thing in itself, of course. It's a religious thing to some degree too, but I always feel like it sort of prevents any personal forward motion.
How is it a religious thing?
I think it's for me, it's religious because of what it's trying to do, which is to collect a group of people together and lift them up and strip them of the sort of the mundaneness for a moment and lift them up into something that's communal and moving toward what could be called God or whatever you want to call that, but moving towards something outside oneself.
And I know that famously, I mean, you say in the book, and you referred to it earlier, that the writing of the songs, the beginning of that process for you is always extraordinarily painful and horrible and makes you depressed. And,
yeah.
And yet you return to it, and it seems with renewed vigor, you know, just from the results. Is that something to do with the fundamental idea that as an artist, you have to constantly reinvent and renew yourself?
Well, what am I going to do if I don't do that, you know? I mean...
Well, a lot of people just coast on the formula, or they don't seem to put the emphasis on reinvention that you do over the long term.
Yeah, I just want the records to get better. And... it's not even that. I just actually want to make good records, and I don't want to make records that are sort of substandard. And it's quite easy to make a substandard record. And so that the effort to do that becomes harder. You know, it just becomes harder. And you see it with everybody. Really?
Oh yeah.
You just sort of—it's. I don't know. It's hard to make a good record.
Is it easy for you to take time off? Are you comfortable with not?
Yeah. No, I love time off.
Because you were comfortable when it was imposed on you in the lockdown, but generally are you?
I love to lock down. Controversially.
I remember.
I liked it because I got to spend a year with my wife. And Earl was with me as well, my son.
Sadly, I was on the phone every other day.
Yeah, we were on the phone all the time writing the book.
Yeah.
That was my other wife, as my wife called you, and I think your wife called me.
Well, sometimes your wife would actually. I remember once Susie piped up from the back of the room after about 2 hours, and I was going, Jesus Christ, she's listening to that for...
She was passing through.
Yeah, she's passing through, okay. Yeah. So what's next?
I've got a really amazing album coming out.
No, I mean, I know that, but... followed by a tour.
Okay, so the next thing I'm doing, I'm taking a month, is to glaze 17, two sets of 17 devil sculptures.
I wasn't even going to ask about that.
Figurines, yeah.
So
no, this amazing man, art dealer character, saw them and fell in love with them, and he's wants to exhibit a series of them and put them on the market.
Wow.
So that'll be really interesting to see, because that was never the intention. And I made like 17 Staffordshire-style ceramic figurines of the devil, the life of the devil, from his death to... his birth to his terrible death, and for some reason I did that through lockdown.
I remember.
And it's they're really coming along.
They are very beautiful. I'm not biased. I dreaded going to your ceramic studio. I was thinking, oh God, the rock stars making ceramics. But it was actually quite. I put it off.
No, it's really one of the worst things about having creative friends is listening to their stuff. You know, where they go, oh, I've made a new record, and you go, oh, really? And yeah, come around and have a listen to it. It's terrifying, right? Or anything, really.
Yeah.
I've just written a script.
Yeah. Just made a Staffordshire pottery.
it's very, very difficult to do, and I try not to lie when I hear somebody's stuff. Like, they play their record.
Really?
And
you're brutally honest.
Well, I'm not brutally honest, but I've worked out ways of, like, you hear it and you're thinking, oh my God, this is fucking terrible. And then you go, whoo, oh my God, whoa. You put everything into that. things like that.
So you lie.
No, it's just like, wow, like, phew.
done verbal. yeah.
And you always know when you've done a terrible show, or someone's thought your show is terrible, when they come back stage and say, man, the lights. or the sound.
Yeah.
Anyway.
On that note, I think it's already 8 o'clock, so we've got half an hour to take questions, I think, because it's very tight with time tonight. We've got to stop exactly instead of the usual thing. So the questions from the audience and questions online.
Okay.
Oh, yes, we can.
There we are.
Yeah.
There we go.
My name's Will. I run the Nick Cave Badsies 20,000 Instagram account. In the book, there was something that... Nick, you said about ghosting album, which never sort of got answered for obvious reasons, but I kind of wanted to know what you think now, since time's gone on, since the book's been written, and I'll just quote it. It says, ghosting feels like it's moving towards me with all the secrets and mysteries in tow. It's as if it's trying to tell me something, and perhaps it is. Perhaps we will reveal itself when we finally get to perform it live, but I really don't know. Well, now, since you've had time to perform it, do you know what it's sort of telling you now?
I think what ghosting was in the end was And I think I wrote about, this is a lovely question, and I think I kind of wrote, we talked about this too in the book, but it became very clear when I was performing those songs that they were, that those songs were, and this requires some abstract thinking, but they were an attempt to, at the time, to improve the condition of the being of my son. They were in some way an attempt to talk to him and to say things to him that I wasn't able to say when he was alive, because you just don't, and then they're just not there. And so I think that became a kind of ongoing conversation with him. And it continues, you know. So, yeah, thank you.
Good question. One more down here. Go over this side. I'm going to be trying to be democratic here, though. Yeah.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Cave. I wanted to ask you, you've obviously got a rich and complex library of your own songs now. Do you ever look at anybody else in the race and go, fuck, I wish I'd written their work?
No. That was easy. Occasionally, you know, I mean, look, I was always jealous at the time. I'm not now, but I was, you know, not just bringing this back to Shane McGowan, but I was always secretly jealous of Shane's capacity to write solid human lyrics that were truly empathetic lyrics. It was something that I didn't have the capacity to do at the time. I developed that capacity, but he had a kind of naturalness about that. So, you know, occasionally I'm jealous of other people's songwriting or wish I could have written that, but not often. Not often.
Okay, online question. People look to you for help and answers. Is it ever a burden?
It's terrible. Look, I have the red hand files, and it's turned into the weirdest thing. And sometimes I'm writing one of them, and I get like almost like a sense, like a dizzying kind of vertigo about what the hell am I doing? I'm answering this question about something that I don't know anything about. That's been asked of me, so I'm kind of giving it a try. I have no sort of authority in these matters. Sometimes they're just straight out agony aunt kind of things. And it's just this weird thing that's developed. And it's become crucial to the way I lead my life. It's, I just, you know, get up and start looking at the questions. And there's so many now. And there's so beautiful, these questions, mostly. You know, it's just become a part of the way I lead my life, but it's not something that I ever envisaged that I would do, and sometimes I don't want to do it.
Do you want to have one more?
Yes, there's another one. I'm going to shorten this because it's quite long, but the questioner says she has a friend, Ella, who's read The Death of Bunny Munro, that's your 2009 novel, and also and the Ass or the Angel. And she says, I heard recently a TV series of Bunny Munro is underway. I wonder if at this point in time, is it important for you at all to be recognized for any of your work outside the music, or maybe outside your music and the Red Hand Files?
They're making Bunny Munro into a TV series. Yeah, they just announced it. So I'm kind of involved a little bit. I've read the first episode, and they can write, and they're doing a good job, and it's good people and a great director. But I tend to let these things happen as they happen. There's a TV thing of And the Ass or the Angel too being made.
Uh-huh.
Nick.
Hi.
My question is, you wrote Ghosting to get over a death. Are you aware of the impact it has getting ready for it?
The impact of what?
Getting ready.
To get ready for death. I have all sorts of responses in the Red Hand files from people who are extremely attached to that record. And I sometimes look at these sort of matters where people say things about things with a pinch of salt, but I think that Ghosting has a special power, that record, that exists beyond just a kind of listening experience. I'm really pleased to hear. I think that my son is somehow inside that record in a way. And
does that answer your question?
Did that answer your question? All right. Well, thank you very much, man. I appreciate that.
Right here, Okay, I'll come to you next time.
Hello, you spoke about the human condition, and we're kind of in this tension of loss. So loss, all of us, from things that happen in life, but also the finishing line of loss. What does peace mean to you within that? What does peace look like?
You mean peace in the world?
No, just peace as in we have this tension and how we deal with the loss of current life and loss of what's to come, I suppose. Because you're saying that there's the finishing line of life.
Well, I don't know what the answer to about peace is, but I do know that that it's this idea that this idea of the precarious nature, our precarious nature, is to me what gives the world meaning. I think the opposite of peace is lack of meaning. And peace for me is to understand that what I'm doing is of some existential benefit to the world. That to me is the thing that makes things worthwhile and gives my life meaning. So I would say that you know, I'm not a very peaceful, I don't have a very peaceful soul in the sense that I know people who do, that just sort of sit around and seem contented with things, and I often envy that. I'm not really like that, but I often question the value of things, and I know that I find that in turning my, the value thing is to sort of turning myself inside out, and looking at the world and looking at people and doing some small thing to help the sort of project of the sort of rehabilitation of the world. That's where meaning is, and I guess in that respect, that's where peace is.
Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Hall. Don't forget, there's more of that discussion in a special extended edit waiting to dig into for Intelligence Squared members. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up and get it all in one go, or just hit subscribe on Apple. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet.